I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my day.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She has written a number of books on the English language. I'm not going to go through the whole list again. Pat, is that okay?
That's okay.
A little bit later. And she visits us once a month to talk about the language and take your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And if you don't need immediate gratification, you can email her directly at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. You can also click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions that WNYC listeners have sent in to her. With that taken care of, what would you like to talk about today before we go to our listeners?
Well, this is something I think that's right up your alley, both because you're a male radio personality, as they say, and just because you have a wonderful voice. But according to a study published in the upcoming issue of the journal American Speech, men who mumble when they talk are perceived by hearers, male and female listeners, as being more masculine than men who speak clearly.
Uh-oh, so I'm not very masculine then.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Although people do complain that sometimes I swallow the last word of a sentence.
Well, how can you help it? You're so masculine. But you're probably wondering, how would a study like this be carried out? Well, the linguist who did this, he analyzed the speech patterns of 8 American radio DJs. Two classical, 2 country western, 1 pop, and 3 rock. And he calibrated in their speech variables like having to do with distinction, distinctiveness, and duration of vowels, precision of consonant articulation, all the several things, very complicated things. And these were all white middle-aged DJs, I should mention. And he then made samplings of their speech. And he had people, a selection of people, listen to them, both men and women, and rate them on their assumptions about these guys as far as friendliness, self-confidence, composure, and masculinity. And, of course, this was entirely subjective. But the DJs who rated the highest on the articulation scales, the classical guys, actually, rated lowest in machismo. Now,
that's because they could pronounce all those French and German words.
I guess so, but you know, French and German words aren't always articulated so well. But at any rate, the ones who rated the highest in masculinity were the mumblers, the ones who skipped consonants, shortened or reduced their vowels, and so on. So I thought that was interesting. This is the first study like this.
This is like body language, except that it is, it's really mumble.
Yes.
You know, there's a whole new movement in film called mumblecore.
Oh, really?
I don't know if people are perceiving the actors there as being more masculine.
Uh-huh.
But it's because a lot of the young actors tend to mumble. Now, Marlon Brando was famous for mumbling, and I think that he was an exemplar of machismo, wasn't he?
Yeah,
especially
I
when he was young
so.
And had all those muscles.
Sure, sure. But, you know, when you're listening to someone on the radio, you can't see him. It could be that this guy with perfect articulation has big rippling biceps and is incredibly masculine, and that the guy with the hard rock station who mumbles is really a little shrimp. But who knows?
That's why radio is radio.
But I should mention one other thing. There have been a lot of previous studies that have shown what you might have already assumed, that women speak more clearly than men. And this is true across languages. It's been demonstrated in English, and that's British, American, and Canadian English, in French, German, Dutch, Hebrew, Swedish, and a lot of less common languages like Creek. that in general, women enunciate more clearly, and that men tend to shorten their vowels and weaken or delete their consonants. So there you go.
We're already getting all sorts of calls and messages. One is, I have no idea how you're going to respond to this, but this listener from the Bronx says, our three-year-old twins, that's mm-hmm. important, use mines as possessive for mine. After much thought, I see a rationale
for
why that might be right. We use yours, his, hers, its, John's. Mm-hmm. Why not mine's?
Right. I think they've made that analogy. That's actually quite smart of them.
Mm-hmm. But it will sound like incorrect English if they keep on doing this.
Right. That will get straightened out very shortly.
We hope so.
I'm sure.
Do you have anything else you want to say before we go to some calls?
Well, I do have some things saved up, but since we have calls, maybe we should go on to those.
Okay, and we'll mix them in.
Okay.
Marilyn from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Marilyn.
That's what I said, I thought. Well, yeah. I'm mumbling. Does that make
no,
me sound more
sorry.
Masculine?
No. I just wanted to know why we no longer have adverbs with L-Y endings. Nobody says go slow. Go slowly anymore. They say go slow.
Uh-huh. I'm glad you asked that, because the book I just finished with my husband, we did a section on that. And actually, it's a myth that adverbs have to have L-Y or that they're necessarily better with L-Y. There's a whole class of adverbs like slow and deep, quick, and many others that have two forms. They have the L-Y form and the non-L-Y form. The non-L-Y are called flat adverbs. And it's perfectly grammatically correct to say go slow or drive slow.
But you wouldn't say through a glass, dark.
Well, you could. But there are conventions about this. You could say drive slow, but you wouldn't say slow drive. You would say slowly drive. So we still have different ways in which we use both forms, but the L-Y adverbs are not necessarily better. Where this idea comes from is that in the 18th and 19th centuries, Latin grammarians felt that English would be better if we had distinctly different forms for adjectives and adverbs. And like Latin, as Latin does. And so, therefore, we should try to use L-Y whenever we could.
So whenever people try to Latinize English, they,
mm-hmm. they come
make
up things,
with things
worse. Like
you can't split an infinitive.
Right. You can't split an infinitive. You can't put a preposition at the end. You have to say drive friendlily rather than drive friendly. So we do get ourselves into weird positions when we try to make English conform to classical languages.
Okay, Marilyn?
Very much.
Okay, we go now to Betsy from Ridgewood. Hi, you're on the air. Betsy, are you there? Okay. You know, one of the problems that some listeners have is that they don't realize that we're on delay.
Oh.
And so, and they put down the phone.
Uh-huh.
And waiting for waiting to hear me on the air, and then of course they're not there when I try to talk to them. If you are hanging on, could you please turn down your radio, because that was a problem in the last call as well. Turn down your radio and just listen on the phone. We're going to try Betsy one more time. Hi, Betsy.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I'm at work and I was on hold. Yes, my question is about the difference between make a decision and take a decision, because I learned make a decision, but mm-hmm. I hear on the news all the time people are taking decisions.
Yeah.
Did that change at some point, or is there one that's more correct than the other?
Well, in American English, it's more common to make a decision. Mm-hmm. However, in British English, they say take a decision quite regularly. Mm-hmm. I was reading a book just a couple of weeks ago, and I came across it again, and it always jumps out at me.
Uh-huh.
This is a decision I've taken with great care. And I would have said made with great care. Mm. But yeah, it's just it's idiomatic that we say make a decision, and maybe the British usage is catching on over here.
We're seeing more and more British usage catching on. Uh-huh. People constantly call to ask about certain other things that are mm-hmm. are Britishisms,
gone missing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps because we have this exchange of cultures, the British are very influenced by American movies, mm-hmm. but we also wind up seeing British television shows and
right.
British movies.
It goes both ways. They're probably over there.
We do speak the same
there.
Language, right?
Well,
kind of.
There are differences of opinion about that, but they're probably even now complaining about American usages slipping into their language. So we see that it's happening the other way.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, and then the version for kids, Woe Is I Junior, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and also Origin of the Specious. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You can reach us by calling us at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. A lot of the questions that are coming in have to do with Britishisms. Doug in Manhattan asks, is opening hours a British usage? I've seen it on signs listing hours of operation at banks, stores, and government agencies.
Yeah, I hadn't run into that, but I think in Britain, don't the pubs close during the day at some point and then open again in the afternoon?
I think that's finally changed, but it may be
true.
Oh,
well, I think that's where opening hours probably came from. I don't know, but that's just a guess.
Let's take another call. This is from Jason in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. I'm calling about the word myriad and the common usage or misusage of it when people say there's a myriad of mm-hmm. instead of, well, I'm basically asking, is of ever correctly used after myriad?
And shouldn't it be a multitude of?
Well, yeah, multitude of would be better. But myriad is one of those words that's evolved in English usage. And I used to complain myself that since myriad meant a number, I think is it 10,000? Whatever. I'll look it up here. But
you should look it up in Myriad Webster's Dictionary.
Or myriad other dictionaries. But it's now evolved so that it's not incorrect to say a myriad of. And
it is acceptable.
It's acceptable. I don't do it. It doesn't mean that you have to do it. You can still say he has myriad opportunities. You don't have to say he has a myriad
right.
of opportunities.
I was led to believe that it was implied, the of was implied.
Well, it was originally implied because myriad was taken to mean, let's see, a very large indefinite number. Let's see, a vast number. Oh, it was originally 10,000. Now it just means constituting a very large indefinite number. So you can say the myriad fish in the ocean, or there are a myriad of fish in the ocean. You can also use it in the plural. There are myriads of fish in the ocean. So it's hard to misuse it now.
A lot
there
of
are
those,
so many acceptable ways to use it.
When we first started doing these segments, people would call in to complain about the misuse of the word decimate.
Yes.
Because they said it has to be
one-tenth.
And, of course, that's not true anymore.
Right. That, too. People will say, well, deci, you know, it means 10. It's right there in the word. So it can
and
only
with myriad, we have to have 1,000
yeah.
or else. Right?
Right. But these things evolve.
A listener from Harlem Harris wants to know if there's a difference in the usage of anyone and anybody, everyone and everybody, someone and somebody.
No, there isn't. Actually, I recently got an email question on that subject, and I answered in my blog because the person felt that someone was formal English and that somebody was informal or colloquial English, and it's not true.
But you do have the different, the extra syllable. And I can't imagine Jesse Jackson saying, I am someone. I am somebody.
Yes.
Really has a lot more impact.
Yes.
So sometimes it's just the
rhythm,
the sound, the poetry of the language.
Right. There are times when you need one more syllable or times when you need one less syllable. And fortunately, in English, we have a big enough selection of words to choose from that we can be poetic and we can choose our words for their rhythms. And that's one of the cases, somebody and someone, anybody, anyone.
We thank you, Harris. We go now to Raul from Brooklyn. Hi, Raul.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. What's happening?
There's just a slight phrase that I always have an argument with my wife about, and I noticed that...
Wait, but you're arguing with your wife over phrases? Aren't there enough things to argue about in a marriage?
But it's something that kind of goes like this. We have been serving the community for 20 years, or we've been serving the community since 20 years?
Oh, for 20 years.
And I noticed that, and not to sort of generalize, but amongst Indians and Indian Americans, I'm Indian American, since 20 years is often used.
Mm.
And I wonder if it was just a translation from the Hindi.
I'm not a Hindi speaker, so I don't know, but since 20 years... is not idiomatic English.
Mm-hmm.
You could say 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
or since 1986,
mm-hmm.
or 19, whatever. But no, you wouldn't say since 20 years.
Great. And can pain be used as a verb?
Can what be used as a verb?
Pain, like paining. Something is paining.
Well, you can say it pains me,
mm-hmm.
but you don't say... I wouldn't say I pain you.
Or my leg is paining.
No.
Yeah,
you'd say my leg is paining me.
But you could say it pained me.
It pained me. My leg
okay.
pained me. Or...
No, I don't know. That's just the oddness of the language. Because in theory, if you say it pains me to hear that,
uh-huh.
why wouldn't those other pains be perfectly acceptable?
Well, you can say my leg is paining me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit, I don't know. Folksy, I suppose.
Yeah.
I see.
But you wouldn't say, I'm painting. Or it's painting. My leg is painting.
This is like scratch and itch. Some people say, my leg is scratching when they mean my leg is itching.
Right.
Estelle from Austin asks, is there an element of variety implied in the word myriad or just number?
I think it's just number.
Because you say there are myriad ways.
Well, yeah, that would mean there are a lot of different ways, and that would imply variety. But the myriad itself just implies a lot of numbers, a number of something.
We're going to take a little break and come back with more of your calls to 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We're talking about the English language with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of any number of books, a myriad number of books on, or just myriad books?
Just myriad books,
myriad
or a myriad
books.
Number of books.
you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You know, after these things, I'm totally confused.
Yeah, I know. I can't speak the language after I get off this show.
Words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my
days. We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor and your calls to 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And at the top of this segment, Pat, I mentioned that people send in questions to you at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. And sometimes you respond to them on the air. Do you have any today?
Yes, I do, actually. Someone sent me an interesting question. And he says he can't help pausing when he encounters contradictory prepositions two in a row, as in, Leslie went out in the woods, out in. Or Morgan is off on an errand, off on. And he says, how can this be right? And it's a very good question.
Except when you're off on an errand, the off is not about something negative. It's another use of the word off, isn't it?
Yes. Well, this is what's happening grammatically. It's interesting because you shouldn't assume those are two prepositions because the function a word performs depends on how it's used in a sentence. And when you use a word like, say, Morgan is off, you're using off as an adverb. And where is Morgan off? On an errand. So when off on there is a combination of adverb and preposition. So sometimes when you think you're seeing two prepositions in a row, you're really seeing an adverb and a preposition. And I have some other examples here.
But this is the equivalent of people asking about driveways and things like that.
Yes, yes, it is. But I think it's grammatically kind of an interesting idea. For instance, here's an example. Leslie looked in on the baby. To look in, look in is a verbal phrase. In is an adverb. It's not a preposition there. On the baby, on is a preposition. So you could say, somebody looked on over my shoulder. She looked down upon the valley.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have these seemingly contradictory words right in a row, and there's no conflict at all. An example, the alarm went off on time.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I was grateful because it got me to work. We go now to Susan from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My question is about the expression I've just heard this year. I'm a law professor, and I hear students making arguments all of a sudden saying their argument is based off of a case when I would think the correct expression is based on. And so I'm wondering if based off of is correct, and if it is, does it mean something different from based on?
No, the correct idiom would be based on.
But I heard that used quite
a bit. You've heard that? Based off something?
I just heard it this year, and then I heard my middle school age daughter use it after I heard my law student
use it.
Oh,
my goodness. I wonder.
It comes off of, they'll say it comes off of this thing instead of it's the out of.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they're combining based on and comes off. Or
it would seem that it should mean the opposite, based on and based off.
Yeah, well, I don't think based off really makes much sense.
Mm. Me neither.
Well, so correct them.
Yeah.
So I do.
Do you take credit off of papers when there are misspellings and grammatical mistakes?
I do.
Oh, good.
I'm proud to.
Thank you so much for calling us. A listener says, I cringe when I hear comprised of versus simply comprises or consists of. Dictionary.com quotes either Random House Dictionary or American Heritage Dictionary usage note. These uses are often criticized, but they occur with increasing frequency, even in formal speech and writing. What do you think?
Well, it's true, they do. This brings up a question. At what point does a usage become misused so routinely that it becomes no longer a misusage? And this is a question people ask me a lot, and I don't really know the answer. I guess when lexicographers start classifying something as standard English, then we have to accept that it's changed. But I had always understood that comprised meant to include or contain. So a basket comprises a dozen eggs, say.
Mm-hmm.
Not the basket is comprised of a dozen eggs, because to say is comprised of would be like saying is included of. But again...
But can you say that the plastic is comprised of any number of petroleum products?
I wouldn't say so. I would say that the petroleum products comprise the plastic. But again, this is something that's it's in flux. It's like disinterested, uninterested. We used to have all these complicated rules about it, and they changed every 100 years or so. Now they've just changed back. So usage is a very funny thing. It's but very it hard does, to pin down.
It does send off alarm bells for some people. I remember when Aaron Copland died, and there was a report in which they said he was very upset that that younger musicians were disinterested in his music. And I thought, well, why would he be upset? After all, that meant that
they hadn't heard it.
or that they weren't taking any money from it or anything like
right,
that.
Right, they had no.
Did communicate the right thing, not disinterested.
Yes.
Having a disinterest means that they weren't stealing from his royalties.
Right, they weren't on the take or something. But no, to get back to that comprise thing, I prefer is composed of. The whole, the plastic is composed of a lot of different elements, but the elements comprise the plastic.
Chris left a question. Can you please talk about the emergence of the term gift, as in they were gifted a leather armchair?
I don't know. Maybe I'm becoming an old fogey all over again, but gifted to me sounds like, you know, the gifted and talented child who is allowed to skip a grade. To be given a gift, I don't think of that as being gifted. Gift as a transitive verb, to gift you. Here, I'm gifting you a new shirt for Christmas. I'm giving you a new shirt for Christmas.
But there's a tendency people to take nouns and make them into verbs.
I know. Now, re-gift, I can understand re-gift because that has a specific meaning to take an old gift and recycle it. So re-gift, it's amusing. But gift somehow as a verb, I just don't quite get it.
Jose from North Bergen, New Jersey is on the air. Hi, Jose.
Hi, how are you? I'm not a native speaker of English, and I'm also handicapped by being a lawyer. So I have a trouble distinguishing when it's proper to use which and that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I always say is that if the information you're introducing is disposable, if it doesn't really have to be there, it's probably which information. If it's integral to the sentence, particularly if you're not setting it off with commas, it's probably that information.
But there are no set rules to this.
Well, there are. There are American rules about it, which are ignored in Britain. I just did a long history of that and which for my blog.
Now, spell check often will correct it when you say which. They'll tell you to say that.
That must be grammar check. I wouldn't trust it. I wouldn't trust a machine's judgment to make that call. Spelling, maybe. To tell you that you've got two the's in a row, that's all right. But I wouldn't trust the machine to choose that or which. But if you, Jose, if you go to my blog and look up that and which, my husband and I just did a long essay about that, the whole history of it, and the difference between American, British, and British usage, which is different.
Okay. Let's hope it helps.
Thank you.
And then stop writing in legalese, Jose. It's really hard to understand any of this stuff.
That's my training.
Well, we go now to Don from Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, folks. I was born and educated in Ireland, which is modeled on the British system, and it was drummed into us that under no circumstances do you finish a sentence with a preposition.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you want to ask somebody, you know, what is their location, you say, what's your location? I mean, you hear it abused here saying, where are you at, or whatever. Is that still as big a no-no as it's always I was told that it is?
Well, there are two points that I want to make. First, it's not correct to say where is it at or where are you at, but not because you're ending with a preposition. It's incorrect because you don't need the at all. The at is redundant.
Yep.
You just say, where are you?
Where are you? Yeah.
Now,
although if you're saying it on a cell phone, I would hope that you don't scream it so that everybody else knows what you're asking.
But no, it's not incorrect to end a sentence with a preposition. That's a grammatical myth. It was invented by Latinists in the late 1700s, and it's never been a bona fide rule of English.
Because in some cases, it forces you into a really weird pretzel-type sentence.
Oh, certainly. And also, English is a Germanic language. Germanic languages naturally can end in prepositions. It's very common in normal sentence structure. It's not a common sentence structure in Latin, but so what? We don't speak Latin.
Okay.
Thank you. One other observation I have, and it drives me absolutely nuts every 2 years for the Winter Olympics and again for the Summer Olympics, and the commentators or the announcers have invented this term. If somebody does well and they come first, second, or third in an event, they are described as meddling in the event.
Oh, yes, yes, to meddle. Yeah, I think that we mentioned that a few weeks ago during the Olympics, that to meddle has crept into the language, and it means to become first, second, or third. There's another one, to podium, which is even worse, I think, which is a reference to the podium that the medalists stand on. So they'll say he's podiumed.
But a lot of people also call the lectern a podium.
Right.
And that always confuses me. He came up to the podium there when there
yes.
is no stand there, but it is
right.
a lectern.
Yes.
So.
Oh, well, it's a wonder we can understand each other at all.
It's a confusing language. Thank you so much for your call. Elizabeth in Brooklyn writes, I teach literature in college, and my students like to talk about how relatable a character is. I've always told them that relatable is not a word, though, of course, I know what they mean. Have you encountered this?
Well, I wonder, do they mean that this is a character they can relate to?
Yes, I think that's what she's saying.
I haven't heard that before.
Not that it's a relative.
I would think that it's a sympathetic character.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are so many other better ways to say that.
Well,
relatable.
I can relate to this person is more personal than
exactly.
This is a relatable character.
Yeah, right. It takes yourself out of the equation.
Although better relatable than ever, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sandra from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to bring to your attention the bring and take issue that mm-hmm. I have. It's one of my pet peeves.
Right.
I just wanted to know, obviously in the UK, bring and take have completely different meanings in the US. It's bring is popularly used for both bring and take.
Is it?
No. I know what you're trying to say. And it is true that there are a lot of people on the East Coast, and I say this as a Midwesterner, people on the East Coast often use bring for all purposes. But no, this is by no means American usage.
Oh, it's an East Coast thing?
Yeah.
Oh, that surprises me.
May even just be New York, as far as I know. But no, we use both bring and take, and they have very different meanings. And part of the reason they get confused, I think it's a matter of perspective. When you're the one who's transporting the goods, do you say you're bringing something or you're taking it? And it depends on the perspective from which you're speaking.
Right.
If you're talking, usually you're talking from the point of view of the destination.
I was always taught as a child that I would take to and then bring back from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, or you could use fetch.
And I think that's...
And fetch and bring back. Mm-hmm. You could use fetch instead. But
and that's just as appropriate in the United States.
Yeah.
So if people are speaking incorrectly, and we do have our regionalisms. New York has its share.
Right.
The British do say queue up, and we say we go online.
Uh-huh.
Ed in Melville asks, if the alarm went off on time, really, didn't the alarm went on time?
Didn't it went? Well, you could
well,
say
you
the
got
alarm
the, point.
The alarm went on
yeah.
on time.
On time. Yeah.
Yes. And in that case, you'd be using on first as an adverb and then as a preposition.
It does feel weird when you use the same word twice, but we do
uh-huh.
the had-hads and things
uh-huh.
like that.
Or I came in time.
Pat will answer your questions if you write to her directly at mailbox at grammar phobia.com. You can click on her blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners and also read some of the columns that she and her husband, Stuart Klarman's anyway.
That's your masculinity.
We'll see you on Wednesday, June 16th, the next time you're on the show.
Very good.